From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Kelly McEvers. In this episode, we talk to Lauren Arrington, a sixth grader from Florida whose science project on lionfish inspired actual scientists.
I was like, well, hey guys, what about the river?
We visit a U.S. aid organization called El Rescate, which was established to help migrants during the Central American Wars of the 70s and 80s here in Los Angeles. It's now assisting the large number of unaccompanied Central American minors coming to the U.S.
The neighborhood where you are right now is the Ellis Island of Central America.
And Jenny Lewis, child actress and frontwoman of the band Rilo Kiley, with her new introspective album called The Voyager. She talks to us about the difficulties she faced creating it. No matter how hard I try to have an open mind, there's a little voice inside that prevents me. That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. Secretary of State John Kerry says evidence is mounting that Russian-backed separatists are to blame for downing a Malaysia Airlines plane over eastern Ukraine. Here's Kerry talking on CNN about the weapons system the U.S. believes brought down that plane.
We know for certain that the separatists have a proficiency that they've gained by training from Russians as to how to use these sophisticated SA-11 systems. We know they have the system, and on Thursday of the event, we know that within hours of this event, this particular system passed through two towns right in the vicinity of the shootdown.
To talk more about this, we spoke to Julia Iaffe, a senior editor at The New Republic. Julia Iaffe, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Kelly.
So this week, after the plane was shot down, you wrote that this would be a major game changer in the Russia-Ukraine conflict. You wrote, make no mistake, this is a really, really, really big deal. Have we seen that reaction that you were expecting, or is that still in the works?
We're definitely seeing it. This was a conflict that had faded from the front pages, and all of a sudden it had brought in people from countries all over the world. You're having people at the highest level of governments in both European countries and the U.S. speaking out forcefully against Putin in a way they haven't in months.
And Julia, the Ukrainians released what they say is an intercepted phone call after the attack. It's supposedly a rebel calling back to his, you know, sort of handler in Russia. The Ukrainians say the man talking is a man named Igor Bezler, basically admitting that his men shot down the plane. You actually met this guy, Bezler, when you were reporting in Ukraine. Can you tell me about him?
So it was totally by accident that we met him. I was there with a photographer, and we were told that if we wanted to operate in this town of Gorlovka, where Bezler was in charge at the time, that we had to go and see the kind of the city bosses inside a captured police station. All of a sudden, this guy shows up, and we realize it was Bezler, who's known as Bis, which is, you know, like the first syllable of his name. It also means demon, and he was just, you know, on one hand, he was very nice to us. He offered us tea, and then he proceeded to go into diatribe about how evil and barbaric the Ukrainian army is, how they don't bury their dead, how they strip the bodies down for valuables and just leave them in the fields, which is kind of ironic given the reports we're hearing from the crash site where rebels are being said to be pillaging the crash site and even going as far as using some of the victims' credit cards.
You've written also that Russian President Vladimir Putin does not like to be backed into a corner. It seems that he is in that corner now. What do you think his thinking is right now? How is he going to go forward?
He's probably troubleshooting. For all the praise he gets in Washington as being brilliant and outfoxing and outmaneuvering the U.S. at every step, he's not very good at thinking far ahead. He's a good tactician, but not a very good strategist. And we're seeing that here. I don't think he ever intended to shoot down an international civilian jetliner. In situations like this, when there's intense public pressure and outcry mounting against him, he tends to withdraw and not say much publicly. He doesn't like to be seen as responding to pressure. He likes to seem completely autonomous.
That's Julia Iaffe. She's a senior editor at The New Republic. Julia, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kelly.
¶¶ 2 years ago, the Republican governor of Kansas, Sam Brownback, announced a set of sweeping tax cuts for small businesses and people with the highest incomes. Last year, Brownback spoke to this show and said the cuts would bring jobs and prosperity to Kansas and set an example for other states to follow.
Let's show what lower taxes, more efficient use of government, more targeted government, let's show a reformed pension system. Let's show these things to the country, and when they work, my belief is they will migrate nationally.
Now, Kansas has a big budget deficit, and projections for the coming years are even worse. Moody's has downgraded the state's bond rating, and this week, more than 100 former Republican office holders in the state endorsed Brownback's Democratic challenger in the fall election. Brownback was elected in a landslide back in 2010, but polls now show the Kansas governor's race is a toss-up. Steve Kraske is a political columnist for the Kansas City Star.
Well, the bottom line, Kelly, is that the state of Kansas is $338 million. It has that much money less than it thought it was going to have, than what was projected going into the year. That's a lot of money. Governor Brownback has tried to put a positive spin on all of this, saying the state can weather this, the state will be just fine. But a lot of folks out here are very concerned that the state is off track and what this might mean for programs such as, you know, public education. People are very worried about that.
And what about the jobs picture? I mean, the Bureau of Labor Statistics says that only 5 states in the country lost jobs in real numbers over the last 6 months, and Kansas was one of them, right?
That's right. Our surrounding states in Kansas did better, with this one exception. So this notion that cutting taxes out here was going to result in this explosion of jobs, it hasn't happened, at least not yet.
I mean, is it fair to Brownback just 1 year in to, you know, do this big assessment of his economic plan and say it hasn't been working?
Well, and that's a great question. And the economic advisors to the governor will say, no, it's not. These things take time to take effect and go into place. And over the long run, the state will be much better off having cut these taxes. Other states that have done this across the country have seen dramatic results as a consequence of cutting taxes to this extent. So, you know, no. But having said that, you know, the governor did bill these tax cuts as a way to begin to change the dynamics in Kansas fairly rapidly. And we haven't seen that out here.
I mean, Brownback and his conservative wing of the Republican Party dominated the elections in 2010 and 2012.
Yes.
And that means a lot of Kansans liked his policies at the time. Do you think Kansans are really ready to so drastically swing the other way?
Well, the poll suggests the answer to that is yes, Kelly. And if you look at Kansas's history, the state does go back and forth, at least in terms of governors, mm-hmm. between Democrats and Republicans. We haven't elected a Democratic U.S. senator out here since 1932. That's the longest streak in the nation. But when it comes to governors, the state has shown a propensity to go back and forth. We'll have to see how the campaign plays out now following the primary on August 5th and going forward to Election Day in November. Campaigns do matter. But as of this moment, certainly, the governor is fighting uphill.
That's Steve Kraske. He's a columnist for the Kansas City Star and hosts the local Kansas City show Up to Date on member station KCUR. Thanks so much, Steve.
Nice to be with you, Kelly.
Malaysia Airlines has released the manifest of passengers who were on that plane that crashed in eastern Ukraine. We know that many of them were bound for the world's largest AIDS conference in Australia. At the opening of the conference yesterday, there was a moment of silence to remember those who had died. Diane Anderson Minchell is the editor-in-chief of HIV Plus magazine, and I asked her about one of the most prominent AIDS researchers who was killed, Dutch scientist Joop Lunga.
He's an inspiration to legions in the HIV community, and so his is a great loss. One of the most important things that he did was he was a very early proponent of a combination antiretroviral medication, which we now know is really the key to keeping HIV undetectable and manageable among people. And so he is one of those people, probably like the top 5 researchers in the world, and he's responsible really for bringing down the number of HIV-infected babies in the world.
Wow. I understand you have been to the conference before yourself. Tell us what goes on there.
Sure. The International AIDS Conference, this is the 20th year. This is the really the world's largest conference on HIV and AIDS. And it's a combination of activists and advocates and researchers. And one of the main things that happens there is people are presenting groundbreaking research and sharing that information with other scientists and healthcare workers. And I think that, you know, this is sort of the great loss. Everybody wants to know, did the cure for AIDS die on that plane?
This is a community that deals with death, that has dealt with death in its own unique way. But it hasn't happened like this. How are people coping?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that anybody who has been in this fight, we've lost, you know, innumerable friends and colleagues over the 30 years, but it's rarely instantaneous like this. You know, it's something we see coming. I think that people who are at the conference right now, and again, it was a mad scene at the conference with people landing and then furiously texting all their friends to find out who might have been on that flight. We were getting dispatches from our colleagues there. And so I think that, you know, for everybody, there's a bit of mourning that has to happen, and there's definitely a bit of grief. But I think that part of being in, you know, the HIV community is that we know to march on. We need to march on. We know we need to honor the work that these people are doing. We need to find out who's going to carry on their work and honor their short lives and do what we've always done, which is sort of to trudge on in the fight against HIV and AIDS.
Diane Anderson Minshall is a journalist and the editor-in-chief of HIV Plus magazine and also an editor-at-large at The Advocate. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
In South Florida, an invasive fish is freaking some people out. It's called a lionfish, and it's this weird-looking stripy thing with poisonous spines. Ecologists think they could threaten shrimp and small fish in the Atlantic. Until recently, ecologists also thought lionfish could only live in the ocean. But then, a 12-year-old proved them wrong.
I mean, scientists were doing plenty of tests on them, but they just always assumed they were in the ocean. So I was like, well, hey, guys, what about the river?
Lauren Arrington's sixth grade project showed that lionfish can survive in freshwater, too. Her dad's a fish ecologist, so Lauren knew some stuff about fish.
Sometimes we would even catch them when me and my dad were fishing. So we dissected plenty of them when we caught them.
Lauren is really into lionfish. So as soon as she heard about the science fair, she knew what she wanted to do.
I wanted to see how far up the river lionfish could thrive. So first off, I thought of putting lionfish in different cages at different river miles. You know, if the further up the river they could still live. But it was just a small sixth grade project, and I really didn't have all the tools necessary for that.
Mm-hmm.
So then my dad was like, well, you could put them in tanks. So I was like, oh, okay. So then I decided to put them in tanks in the river center. And then there I could just watch them and make sure none of them died, because when we heard that the science fair would disqualify you if any of your projects died.
So you're working on under a pretty strict set of rules there. The subject of your experiment cannot die.
Yeah.
Okay. So you put some fish in different tanks, and then what did you do?
So six lionfish, six different tanks. Every night for 8 days on the five experimental fish, I would lower the salinity 5 parts per thousand. So, parts per thousand is how you measure salt in the water. 0 parts per thousand is fresh water, and then 35 parts per thousand is ocean salinity.
Uh-huh.
So, we found the lionfish that we captured in around 25 parts per thousand. So, when all the experimental fish were still alive at 6 parts per thousand, I was like, pretty amazing.
And then, I mean, it didn't stop there, right? I mean, there was some research published, a research paper published by North Carolina State, and they mentioned you.
Yeah, because he confirmed my results. And so, you know, he credited a sixth grader for coming up with his idea.
That's Dr. Craig Lehman of North Carolina State. So it was because of you that he went on and did further research on this. How did that feel?
I was like, oh. And then friends at school were like, hey, congrats on being published in the science journal, you know, and I was like, yeah, that's me right there.
Lauren, could you put your dad online for a second?
Yes, ma'am. Yes.
Hello, this is Albrecht.
Yeah, hi. So I guess you talk science with your daughter a lot.
Yeah, that's kind of how we are. We're a science bunch of dorks in our family.
I have to ask, I mean, it sounds like Lauren had some pretty good ideas about this experiment. How much of this was you and how much of this was her?
I'm the dad, so participating, but very proud to say this is her ideas. It certainly was her work, sitting, measuring salinity, you know.
Well, you must be very, very proud.
Very much so. Very pleased.
That is Aubrey Arrington and his daughter Lauren joining us from Jupiter, Florida. Thanks so much, you guys.
Thank you very much.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Kelly McEvers.
The following message will be repeated in Spanish and English.
Let's say you're from Central America. You live here in the U.S. Your child, your niece, your cousin has just crossed the border alone. One of the tens of thousands of children who've crossed into the U.S. this year. How do you find them? You call this government hotline.
If you're calling to locate a minor child and the unaccompanied child is in our care, we will forward your information to the facility where the child is placed, and they will contact you directly.
But what if you yourself entered the U.S. illegally, and you're afraid to call the government? You might call this guy instead.
We started getting calls from parents from Virginia, Washington, D.C., Atlanta, Houston, San Francisco, calling us, you know, I have my kid detained. What do I do?
That's Salvador Sanabria. He heads an organization called El Rescate. It means the rescue, and it's in a part of L.A. that has one of the highest populations of Central Americans in the U.S.
The neighborhood where you are right now is the Ellis Island of Central America.
In other words, while protests are breaking out around the country against housing migrant children in shelters, and politicians in Washington are arguing about whether to authorize emergency funds, this is how the migrant crisis is playing out on the ground. Churches, volunteers, nonprofit groups that were already in place are reuniting families and helping them get settled while they wait for a court date to determine whether they can stay in the U.S., a wait time that could take years. Sanabria says people find familiar faces here in L.A.
So they don't feel the shock of landing in an unknown nation that doesn't speak your language, and where you look different to the majority of the people.
That's how it was for Rosie and her two young kids. They didn't want us to broadcast their last names. They're worried about calling attention to themselves and their situation. The family used to live in San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador. Rosie ran a beauty salon, but then members of MS-13, the infamous gang that controls her area, started demanding money.
So how much do they want?
¿Cómo cuánto le piden?
Aproximadamente son 200 mensuales.
$200?
Mensuales.
$200 a month. But Rosie only made about $50 a week. She couldn't pay the gang. And she heard the gang was trying to recruit her 15-year-old son.
Y yo tomé mis dos hijos y vámonos.
So I took my two kids and I left, she says. Just got on a bus and headed north. By the time she got to Mexico, she paid a smuggler $1,000 to help her, her son, and her 10-year-old daughter, Natalie, cross the Rio Grande in a raft.
¿Cómo estuvo el agua? ¿Tenías miedo? ¿Estaba frío?
Tenía miedo.
She said she was scared.
The family was picked up by Border Patrol, detained, then released pending an immigration hearing. That's how a 2008 law says children from all countries that do not border the U.S. should be processed. If they're with their mothers, officials often let the family stay together. Rosie eventually came here and got a job at a beauty salon. Her son is in summer school, where classes are in both Spanish and English. Rosie and the kids eventually will have to appear in court. She's come to El Rescate to get a lawyer.
What does she think would happen if she did get deported and have to go back?
Corremos peligros. Corremos peligros, sí, la verdad. Los tres.
She says that the three of them, her and her children, run a great danger if they get deported.
Rosie says she will owe the gang money for all the time she's been gone. $200 a month for every month since April. Salvador Sanabria says whether Rosie and the kids are deported back to El Salvador is up to one immigration judge to decide. Some judges are lenient, some are harsh.
That's why I keep telling the mothers and the fathers and the kids, you know, do well in school, that might count in your favor when facing an immigration judge.
Sanabria has been in this neighborhood for decades. El Rescate was first set up to help people fleeing the civil war in El Salvador in the 1980s. Now, he says, it's like history is repeating itself. People are fleeing violence, he says, and they want to start a new life. Time now for the latest installment of our series, My Big Break, about triumphs, big and small. Sean T is the man behind workout programs like Hip Hop Abs, Focus T25, and Insanity. Go, push, get in it and move. Come on, y'all. He got his start as a dance teacher and a choreographer. The story of his big break begins with someone breaking him down.
I was in this abusive relationship for 4 years, too long. It was a verbal and physical abusive relationship. One day, I got my first big choreography job in New Jersey, and I got picked as one of the main choreographers after the show. I mean, there were people that wanted my autograph, and I was really no one. My partner at the time said, "You'll never be a professional dancer, so you can immediately delete that dream from your head." No one out there is going to stop me from living the life that I want to live. I gained up enough strength to leave that relationship, and one of my friends said, "Hey, why don't you take a vacation, come out to Los Angeles, we have a house on the beach," and he was like, "Before you come, I need you to get some headshots." And I'm like, "Why do I need to get headshots? I'm just coming out there to lay on the beach and have a good time." He said, "I need you to get some headshots." Let me tell you, those abs were popping on those shots. I flew out to LA. I found out that there was a really good dance school, so I went there. There was a dance audition for this new dance agency that was happening around the corner. I had my headshots on the back seat of the car. I remember I looked in the back seat and I'm like, "Do you go in or do you just drive back to your friend's house to the beach?" I walked in and then I looked around and I realized I was really out of place. These people were at an audition. I mean, the girls had makeup, the guys had these sick outfits on, and I looked like pretty much an athlete that just left the gym unshowered. Oh well, the music comes on, and let me tell you guys, I was freaking living in these dance moves. I was like, "I don't care what happens, they're gonna remember me even though I don't even live here." So there was like 200 people at this audition. At the end, it ended up being 7 guys and 5 girls, and they put us on video and they were like, "You know, if we want you, we'll give you a call in a couple weeks." And I literally left there like, "Whatever, this doesn't matter, I don't even really care." I went back home to New Jersey. 2 weeks later, I was at the laundromat with my pocket full of quarters when I got the phone call that the agency wanted me to move to LA to pursue a career in dance. So I get there, I was dancing, I did some TV shows, I did some musicals, I was teaching a dance class, and my dance class at the gym was really popular. So my big break came when a friend called me and said, "Hey, there's this company named Beachbody that wants you to see if you can develop a project with them." So I go into the Beachbody office, I ended up being there for 2 hours, and that day, I left with my contract for Hip Hop Abs. It was just the most incredible feeling. I knew that I had potential that someone was trying to push down. Push, push, y'all, push, push. Come on, come on, y'all. Look at that power. This is insanity. Now, today, in my workouts, I like to tell people to dig deeper, and I like to motivate them and say, "I know you can do it. Dig deeper." You know, I love to work out with people who are doing insanity for the first time because they look at me and they're like, "Oh my God, you really get out of breath too." And I'm like, "Abso-freaking-lutely, insanity is very difficult for me to do." People, you have no idea. I understand why you feel weak and why you might be not as confident as you want to be.
all you have to do is tell yourself, I can do this, and I know that it's possible.
That's Sean Thompson, better known as Sean T, the creator of Hip Hop Abs, Insanity, and lots of other fitness programs. We want to hear about your big break. Send us an email at mybigbreak@npr.org. A few years ago, I met this guy named Tim Bomba. And by like the second or third time I'd talked to him on the phone, Tim was convincing me to sign up for a triathlon. Tim has done lots of races, marathons, even two Ironman triathlons. And he's kind of a proselytizer. Here in LA, he teaches a clinic for the local triathlon club on how to do distance swimming in the ocean.
Okay, you guys want to just come down and we'll go over how to start?
Okay, you might be thinking, do you really need to take a class in that? You do. The hard part is learning how to get past the breaking waves and out to the place where the ocean's more calm. The fact that Tim Bomba is teaching this class at all is pretty amazing.
I wasn't a swimmer for most of my life. I was not only not a swimmer, I was terrified of water. I remember even back in grade school taking lessons, I could not let go of the side of the pool. So my entire life, I've been terrified of water. We're going to take you in now, and you're going to hear us call dive. Again, the top of the wave is where the white water is. That's where all the power is. That's where we don't want to be. We don't want to be anywhere near the top of that wave. We want to be as far underneath the water surface as possible. I grew up in Pittsburgh, as far away from an ocean as you could imagine. And there was a period of time when I wasn't on the best terms with my family. I was in New York, they were in Pittsburgh. And I got a call from my dad one day saying, you know, they're going to be traveling from Pittsburgh to the Jersey Shore. And they were going to spend the night in Philadelphia. And would I be interested in coming down and seeing them and to sort of get things back on track? And I said, yeah, you know, I'll do that. So I went down that night. I hadn't seen anybody for 2 years, including my two brothers. We had a chance to spend some time together. The next day I got the call. My youngest brother drowned in the ocean. He was 16. I was 30. There's always been that thought, I was called to see him just that one last time. And maybe this does go back to why I do it. Okay, when you hear us say dive, you dive. No, watch the water, Kelly. Watch. Ready? Dive!
We've seen people with their goggles on start crying, you know, when they're at the beach, just because they're so terrified. And people who are new to the water, I think they want to relate to somebody who has also shared their experience, but has gone on from that experience. And that's pretty much what we work at.
Okay, you came up a little early, but you got to dive better. And again, always watch the water, watch what's going on, see what's going on out there in front of you.
I was working on a film that, and this is about as spiritual as I'll get, that addressed sort of the mind-body connection, meaning what you think about is what you become. And I was pretty cynical about that film and about that message, but I thought, why not at that point in my life, I was 52, you know, why not try it? And it took a long time. You know, it was getting back into the pool, it was doing the exercises that the five-year-olds are doing, getting my face in the water. But I still had this sort of underlying concern about being in the water. Till the one day, I was driving down to the ocean, and for lack of a better term, I had this extremely detailed vision of me in the wetsuit swimming a mile. That was the day I did the mile.
You good?
That was awesome. I've been out with that look in a long time.
So, I mean, I was watching you. You have a good stroke when you swim, and you guys seem to be pretty comfortable on the surface of the water, which is good to see.
If you are new to the ocean, then you can make every excuse in the world, as I used to not go in on a given day. And at the end of this parking lot, when you're about to hit the road, there's a stop sign. I want people, when they hit that stop sign, to, whether it's figuratively or literally, do a fist pump. Go, yes, I did something today. because that sets the tone for the rest of so many things, and it has almost nothing to do with swimming.
Tim is so into encouraging people, he now works as an announcer at triathlons all over the country, standing at the finish line and cheering people in. Jenny Lewis was one of those child actors you might have seen on shows like Growing Pains or Mr. Belvedere. But then she started making music. And in the late 90s, that started taking off. Once her band Rilo Kiley scored this hit in 2004, it was kind of hard to go back to sitcoms. And it's bad news. Baby, I'm bad news. Jenny Lewis founded Rilo Kiley with her boyfriend, Blake Sennett. But when they broke up, the band broke up too. Her new solo album, The Voyager, took 5 years to make. Five long, hard years. And I started my conversation with Jenny Lewis by asking her how she said making The Voyager got her through one of the most difficult periods in her life.
Way to put it all out there, Kelly.
Sorry.
And I actually direct that at myself as well. My band broke up. My father passed away. And I started experiencing insomnia for the first time in my life.
I read at one point that you didn't sleep for 5 days or something like that. I mean, how is that even possible?
I don't know how I survived that. Your memory goes, physically you don't feel well, emotionally you're all over the place. You know, if you miss one night of sleep, if you can only imagine 5 nights of not sleeping.
I sort of can,
unnerving.
But I mostly can't. I mean, yeah, I've done some work that's kept me from sleeping, obviously had a child that keeps you from sleeping, but that much prolonged sleeplessness, I mean, were you just kind of like delirious and tripping sometimes?
Yeah, I was in an alternate state of reality.
In that altered state, were you also creating things, writing songs?
I was. I worked on my lyrics while I was lying awake. I've been wearing all black since the day it started. When I stopped and looked back as my mind departed, I've been losing sleep and I cannot sit still. I'm not the same woman that you were used to.
You know, one of the things that had sort of brought this about was the death of your father. I mean, you didn't grow up with him in your life, but you got close to him later. Can you just tell me about that a little bit?
Yeah, my parents divorced when I was 3 years old. They had a lounge act in Las Vegas where I was born. The band broke up and the marriage dissolved, and my mother and my sister and I moved to California, Southern California. And I didn't see my dad a lot growing up. He was on the road a lot. I'd see him every couple years. And when he got sick, I reached out to him. And that's when our relationship really began. And we talked a lot during that time. And, you know, just those basic things that you don't know if you don't spend time with your parent, you know, like, what was my grandmother like? What was it like growing up on the road? He was a really special, special person.
The song on this album, You Can't Outrun Him, is a song about that, is a song about getting to know him. And I guess two souls will meet again when the universe thinks they should, even if
you know, my father was very special. He was a musical genius. He joined a group called the Harmonicats when he was a kid, and he traveled his entire life. So, you know, flash forward to my life on the road, where I wake up in a different city every day, and I'm not the best at maintaining, you know, some of my relationships as well. So I kind of, I let him off the hook.
You identify with him.
I do. In the end, though, despite all the running, he found himself surrounded by all of his children, you know, in the last week of his life. And the love in that room was immense. You better talk quickly, 'cause my sister's at the door. 'Cause I wanna know everything, who I am and what it's for. What the Lord has planned for you, I guess that it was meant. Wanted to get to know you before you were dead. You can't outrun us.
I'm talking with Jenny Lewis about her new album, The Voyager. It comes out at the end of the month. Do you think a song is better if you write it while you're going through the things you're writing about? Or is it better to sort of wait until you get some perspective on it first?
That's a really interesting question. You know, I thought about that while writing this record. In particular, with regard to my father and his passing, you know, I write music really to make myself feel better. But in attempting to express grief, it felt really cheap sitting down to write about something that I had just gone through that was devastating. The loss of a parent is devastating. And I couldn't write about it in the moment. I really needed time to reflect. And I needed time to reflect on how I felt, because I didn't even understand how I felt. So I think, you know, it depends on the subject, it depends on the song, but I think life is the most important thing, and you have to live that first. And then your art comes second.
You know, it's funny. I read the lyrics to the songs on this album before I listened to the songs. And I have to say that they seemed a lot darker on the page than when I listened to the music. I used to think you could.
I've always just had sort of a dark take on life, I suppose, and hopefully the music transcends that in a way. I've been singing this Rilo Kiley song on tour the last couple months called A Man Me Then Jim, and the opening line is about suicide. and I'm opening for this guy called Ray LaMontagne, this artist, and you know, playing to his audience every night. I'm like, what are these people thinking? Who is this maniac up here in a rainbow suit singing about suicide?
That sums it up. Wearing a rainbow suit, talking about suicide.
Just like weird adult party clown, bummer, performer.
That's singer and songwriter Jenny Lewis. Her new album, The Voyager, comes out on July 29th. And starting on Monday, you can sample every track from the album at our exclusive First Listen. Go to nprmusic.org. Jenny Lewis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For the week ending July 20th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Becky Sullivan, Daniel Hajek, and Denise Guerra. Our intern is Jen Velez. Patrick Murray is technical director with technical support from Leo Del Aguila. Quinn O'Toole is senior editor and Steve Lichtai is senior producer. I'm Kelly McEvers. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.